welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Well, as arguments rage this week over budget equity and legal integrity, it's Writers' Festival time in August. And in our first hour tonight, we're taking the time to meet some of those in town for the show. What happens when scientist, broadcaster and humanist child of a multi-faith Christian Muslim family, Jim Al-Khalili, joins Jewish atheist Anthony Lowenstein and Muslim writer on Jesus the Zealot, Reza Aslan, as they sit down with me in front of an audience at the Sydney Writers' Festival, and a session we called An Unconventional Faith. Hello and welcome. My name is John Cleary. I'm the host of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio, a program that can be guaranteed to put you to sleep if you're if you're with us. This afternoon, no such luck. An audience and a group of panellists who are designed to keep us on the edge of our seats. Let me introduce our panellists to you. On my immediate left, Jim Al-Khalili. Jim is a scientist, an author and a broadcaster. He's Professor of Physics at the University of Surrey, where he also holds a chair in the public engagement of science. Jim's written many books, including Pathfinders, The Golden Age of Arabic Science, which looks at the remarkable period from the 8th to the 14th centuries across the Islamic world. And of course, for the BBC, Jim is one of the presenters of The Life Scientific, in which he talks to leading scientists about their life and work, finding out what motivates them and sort of niggling away at the sort of things that may bug them. Jim also comes from a multi-faith Muslim Christian background, and he happens to be the current president of the British Humanist Association. Next to Jim, Anthony Lowenstein. Many of you will know Anthony. He's an independent Australian journalist, author of two best-selling books, My Israel Question and The Blogging Revolution, co-author of For God's Sake, co-editor of Left Turn and After Zionism. As a journalist, he's written widely for outlets such as The Guardian and The Huffington Post, and he's a research associate at the University of Technology's Australian Centre for Independent Journalism. His most recent book is Prophets of Doom: How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. Anthony is Jewish and an atheist. Reza Aslan. Reza, his first book, No God But God, was named one of the 100 most important books of the decade. Last year, Reza's latest book became a YouTube phenomenon when, I'm sure as many of you have viewed, the Fox News interview on YouTube, which went crazily off the rails into territory very close to religious bigotry. Reza happens to be a Muslim writing about Jesus in Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. It's a provocative book, and it challenges some long-held assumptions about the man we know as Jesus of Nazareth. Reza also comes from a Muslim, multi-faith Christian family. Will you welcome our panellists? Jim Al-Khalili, let me begin with you. At your inaugural address to the British Humanist Association, without dropping your atheist cloak, you nevertheless suggested a more nuanced engagement with religion. You choose to take religion seriously. Why?
For me, being a humanist is about... some people talk about humanism as some... another religion or another sect or cult. For me, it's just a way of viewing the world, a way of respecting other people's views. So as a humanist, it's not so much that taking religion seriously, but taking and respecting people's personal belief and faith seriously. I was asked to take on the presidency of British Humanist Association, I think because they felt I was... What some people term an accommodationist. Okay, this is what sort of the sort of more extreme end of atheist thought defines someone like me. That I'm prepared to respect others' religion, others' beliefs, regardless of what I think of them. And I think it comes down to my background. I grew up, as you say, in a multi-faith family. My mother is a born-again, evangelical Christian, church-going. She's probably the only person in her Bible study group who's not a creationist, and she's very disturbed about that, which is good. And my father's a Shiite Muslim, who was probably pretty agnostic now. So I grew up believing in God. Allah was just Arabic for God, and so the Abrahamic religions were sort of very, very similar. But then my scientific training took over, I guess, and I realized that if there is some ultimate truth out there, I want to seek it through rationalism. And my science really guided me towards my humanist views. But I still think of myself as a cuddly atheist. I always say that Richard Dawkins, people talk about Richard Dawkins as a militant atheist, but what he has done is expand the spectrum of what it means to be an atheist. That 10, 20 years ago, you don't say you're an atheist in polite conversation, you say you're agnostic, because after all, who can be sure? Now you can say, well, I'm an atheist. I'm not like Richard Dawkins, I'm much more sort of cuddly atheist.
We shall examine your cuddliness as the discussion goes on. Anthony, you're somebody who is Jewish culturally, but you also say, I'm an atheist. Now, again, a few years ago, people were saying, no, that's contradictory. You can't say that.
They still do. But, yeah, I mean, sorry, go on.
No, you.
I think one of the things for me, I grew up in a very liberal Jewish home. It wasn't rammed down my throat. I grew up in Melbourne. For me, Israel has been a defining reason why many of us, and I speak in the collective, have turned away from organized Jewish religion, because Zionism has become a new religion for many Jews. That many liberal Jews in America don't go to synagogue, don't really practice anything, and yet for them they are either uncritical towards Israel and its occupation policies against Palestinians, or they simply have replaced Jewish religion for Zionist religion. And this to me is unhealthy. I think it's bankrupting. I think it's led to a very unhealthy situation where there's an ability that Israel would not be able to get away with what it's doing against the Palestinians unless there was massive diaspora support, mainly in the US, of course, lesser extent the UK, Europe and Australia. But the danger, I think, in replacing Judaism, which has a long tradition of dissent, and that's why I still am happy to call myself a Jew. I don't practice anything. I don't believe in God. I do call myself an atheist as well, and I'm going to sort of say I don't want to be too cuddly. But I think that the Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, new atheist movement, so to speak, which came particularly out of the post-9/11 environment, is profoundly racist and profoundly discriminatory. And you have to ask yourself why many of those individuals were so keen to align themselves with the Bush administration policies about bombing pretty much the Muslim world. Hitchens is obviously passed on now, was a brilliant man. I think he was a brilliant guy. There's no question about that. But him, like a lot of other people post 9/11, became these scared little boys. And they decided to hitch themselves with a policy which was really about subjugating the Arab world, but also choosing that the way to so-called liberate or assist is to bomb them. Iran, potentially Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, etc. So I don't want to be a part of them, and I think atheism can mean something different. So in closing, I would say that I am proud of being a Jewish atheist, but one of the things I'm trying to do, and I'm not alone in this, is to say that you can be a proud Jew, but also anti-Zionist. You can be against the concept of a Jewish state because it inherently discriminates against those who are not Jewish.
Reza, you share something with Jim too, and that is a multi-faith, a mixed-faith heritage, parents of different traditions, Muslim mm-hmm. and Christian, mm-hmm. yet you too take belief seriously.
And my wife is a Christian. Yeah, absolutely, I take belief seriously. I mean, as a scholar of religions, as someone who's studied the religions of the world, it becomes very difficult for you to take any one religion all that seriously, because what you learn very, very quickly is that all these religions are essentially different languages for expressing the similar emotions. They're languages made up of symbols and metaphors. And those symbols and metaphors are important, but they are ultimately metaphors, that they stand for something else. And so what I'm interested in is that something else, faith and what faith means and what it means to sort of believe that there is something beyond the material realm, that there is a transcendent reality that you can actually commune with, that you can feel and experience? And how do you go about experiencing that? And that's what religion does. I think we have to understand that religion is not about beliefs and practices. This is probably the biggest fallacy that people have about religion. Religion is far more a matter of identity than it is a matter of belief and practices. It's about who you are as an individual, how you see yourself in an indeterminate world, the place that you see, the relationship between creator and creation. All of those things are involved in the phrase, I am a Jew, I am a Christian, I am a Muslim. I think it's an unsophisticated view to think of religion as just, you know, believing in God or going to church or mosque or something like that. And for me, what I'm really fascinated by is what stands behind that identity, what stands behind those metaphors. And so that's why I study the religions of the world, and that's why I'm so interested in religious identity, in the sort of history of religions, prophetic experiences. Those things to me are profoundly important because they are as relevant to today's world as they've ever been.
I guess the question is, in what ways are they relevant? Jim, it was thought perhaps 30 years ago in scholarly and literary circles, and certainly in broadcasting and publishing circles, that religion, we could put it in a box, it would gradually fade away, and look, we could all get on with being rational human beings. That hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened. I think a lot, certainly in the UK, there is still a large swathe of sort of non-religious, secular society who still thinks that is happening. Census after census sees the number of people who define themselves as non-religious, not in the way that Reza defined, but not, as in not believing in a divine creator who are atheists. That number is rising. So a lot of people will say, look, secularization is winning, and pretty soon there won't be anyone religious. And it's such a narrow perspective on how humanity has evolved. Religions, the Abrahamic religions and the other most successful religions in the world, have survived for so long for good reason, because they are based on simple, very good ideas, very persuasive ideas that people buy into. And you can't dismiss those very easily. You know, the reason why the great Abrahamic prophets are still so powerful today is because those ideas are persuasive. And I don't think, even with the spread of secularization, the advances in liberalization, modern technology, the fact that we don't need, there will be more and more people who don't need religion, but there's no way I can imagine religious belief fading or shrinking beyond a certain point.
Yeah, let me add to that for a moment. So the World Catholic Encyclopedia does a major global survey of this. At the beginning of the 20th century, about one half of the world's population identified itself with one of the five major religions: Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism. 100 years of secularism, of scientific advancement, and that number is now two-thirds. So, what we are finding out is, number one, globally, even the more economically and politically advanced that we become, even the more secularizing our politics become, religious identification is on the rise. Now, I keep saying religious identification. I don't mean to say religion is on the rise. The number of people who freely associate themselves with a religious tradition, and indeed do so as opposed to identifying themselves ethnically or nationalistically or tribally, that number is on the rise. What does that mean insofar as actual, religiosity? Probably not much. I don't think people are more religious today than they were, because religion itself is constantly transforming and changing and absorbing other ideologies. But the fact of the matter is that we've been talking about the death of God for 100 years, and
he's,
I think,
alive.
He's still very much alive.
Anthony, do you have...
I guess I would just say briefly about that. I mean, it's hard to disagree with what either these guys have said, and yet, of course, there are so many profound issues now. I think increasing technology and globalization has meant that the reality of the profound problems within religions, the fact that you have in pretty much every Western country and elsewhere issues of massive sexual assaults, rapes, in the Catholic Church, for example, and other churches, equally deep problems in the Muslim faith about certain behaviours towards women, minorities, etc., in certain parts of the Muslim world. In the Jewish faith, you have clearly a lot of problems as well, in every faith. I mean, it's not unique to one. It just happens to be in the last 20, 30 years that the Catholic Church has been, in some ways, you know, it's been highlighted their failings, to put it mildly, and I think to continue. And it's interesting, I think it's not accidental that the new Pope, relatively new, comes from a part of the world where the Church's popularity is not decreasing and not declining. I wasn't inside the those lovely, charming old men who made that decision, thank God. But I think you'd be fairly clear that that was done for political reasons. These things don't happen accidentally.
You're with Sunday Night and me, John Cleary, on ABC Local Radio. We're at the Sydney Writers' Festival with Jim Al-Khalili, Anthony Lowenstein and Reza Aslan. There's an interesting observation made a couple of years ago. Christopher Hitchens, just before he died, had a discussion with his brother, Peter, at the Pew Forum in the States. So just let me read a quote from Hitchens in that discussion. He observed that Christendom, the frame that had held European civilization together for much of the past 1,500 years, had destroyed itself in the 20th century in two disastrous wars. He then made this observation, quote, George Orwell wrote that the problem of civilization would be exactly this. He said, how will we now inculcate ethics, teach morality to the people, to the majority, in the absence of a spiritual authority that commands respect and that has innate presence, that has the respect? With this decline in the authority of religion, how shall we teach ethics and morals? That's Hitchens quoting Orwell. And he goes on to say, but if you go around the public halls and provincial theatres, as I do wherever I can, and engage with belief and believers, you'll find to an extraordinary extent that kind of ethical humanism with a vague spiritual content is now extremely commonplace. It reinforces what you're saying, Reza, that and you, Anthony, that whilst people are suspicious of institutional faith and institutional expressions, they're still very reliant on some sort of spiritual reservoir, be it innate or internal, that reinforces their view of the way the world should work. It's something about people, Reza.
Right. And again, this goes along the lines of all the sort of surveys and the data that we are seeing. We're still the two largest religions, Islam and Christianity, though they are transforming dramatically. Islam as a global religion is moving northward and westward. Christianity as a global religion is moving southward and eastward. Religious identification, as I say, is on the rise, but so is issues such as environmentalism, scientific advancement within religion, creationism is decreasing more and more. Indeed, conservative religious figures will gladly call themselves evolutionists. This is what religion has always done. When we found out that the earth was not the center of the universe, Christianity didn't go away. If the heavens open up and an alien comes down in the middle of Sydney and says, greetings from Alpha Centauri, Christianity won't go away. It'll just take that information, absorb it, and move on. Religions survive because of their malleability. And so as we become more scientifically advanced, as our understanding of the universe becomes more sophisticated, religion will simply take that understanding, take that material, whether it's the belief in multiple universes or whatever the case may be, adapt it into religious ideology and move on.
Jim, has the discussion that you indicated before, that the Dawkins, Hitchens sort of drawing of sort of lines in the sand discussion actually frustrated what should be a very productive debate?
No, I don't think so, actually. I think it's helped encourage much broader open debate because it's now, say, it's spread the spectrum of what it means to be not religious, but to say that I don't believe there is a divine creator. It used to be an extreme view. And as I say, you know, you had to say you were agnostic in order to, not to sort of suffer the ridicule of people who regard you as an extremist. You're not, certainly in the UK, no one, certainly in the circles that I move in, is regarded as an extremist if they say they're an atheist. It's become
now they're regarded
acceptable.
As an extremist if they say they're religious, in some circles.
In some circles, yeah. I think, as Reza says, you know, religion is not going away, and religion will absorb changes in attitude, changes, advances in our knowledge of how the universe works. I do despair at how slowly sometimes that takes place. How do you even begin a debate on evolution theory in the Muslim world? You know, who will say, well, you know, we're happy with evolution theory, you know, all the way up to the apes, but don't you tell me that humans evolved from apes? That's just ridiculous, you know. And the debate that happened in the Christian world, in, you know, 150 years ago, has yet to happen freely in the Muslim world. It's starting. But I think the point about, you mentioned about this, the religion, or the quote of Orwell, that religion or some spiritual guidance is needed to provide the moral and ethical guidance. That's where I think attitudes are changing, or certainly have to change. The notion that you need God to provide your moral compass. For me, as an atheist, that's ludicrous. I don't need God to be good. I don't need God to tell me what is right or wrong. On the contrary, for me, I'd say I want to be good. I want to show empathy, compassion, consideration, kindness, not because I'm afraid of a divine power punishing me or rewarding me if I am.
That raises another question, though. Where do these ideas about the good come from? Where do they emerge from? And that's a question that religious people will ask. You sat down with Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he had a view. Now, you didn't dismiss Rowan Williams as a sort of fundamentalist.
No, he's too smart for that. I couldn't win an argument.
He had a view about where ideas of the good are formed.
And that was a view that I didn't agree with. Because for me, those ideas, the conscience that we have as humans, is what defines our humanity. When people say, those are Christian values, I'll say, no, those are human values that have been adopted by the major religious faiths. Christianity has molded Western society for 2,000 years about the way you should behave, the way you should be good. But that's not formed out of Christianity. That was around. Society was different for 2,000 years ago. I'm not saying they borrowed from some pagan ideology.
Oh, but they did. They absolutely did.
Would the idea of the person that has emerged over the last 200 years in its fully formed notion of the individual have been capable if we had been living in a moral framework determined by only that world described by Homer in the Odyssey and the Iliad, Reza?
Right, but I would say that both the Enlightenment and at the heart of Christianity is this notion that the human being is the center of the moral universe. You know, Jim was very right in saying that it's not that Christianity gave birth to these moral values, it's that it took moral values that were very much a part of how we construct our society and gave it a sacred quality to it. And it really was borrowed. I mean, you know, if you want to talk about Christian values coming from, you know, the Ten Commandments are a regurgitation of the Code of Hammurabi, which was written, you know, hundreds of years before the Ten Commandments. The Code of Hammurabi simply reenacts the Cyrus Cylinder, which was written, you know, even before then. You know, you can go back in time as far as you want to. And from the very moment in which human beings began to live in collectives, there had to be an understanding about how we maintain cohesiveness of identity, how we maintain order, how we maintain stability, what we do about retribution and the breaking of rules. All of those things are in our DNA. It's not like one day Jesus showed up and taught us how to be. This is not how it works.
And, of course, the issue which is equally relevant to me is we can't ignore religion and politics. I mean, to me, they go intimately together. I mean, the fact is, in the last 100 years, in fact, even before that too, virtually every corner of the world has been touched by politics or imperialism, and that word we don't really talk about so much these days, but I think we should, because there are consistent levels of invasion, occupation, etc., whether it's the modern world or years ago, whether it's parts of Africa, Latin America, our part of the world here, and the effect and the use and abuse of religion to justify, defend, etc., is clear. I mean, why don't you look, for example, at the very problematic role of the church, for example, during the Second World War and the Holocaust, the role of the church in Latin America, the role of the church in many places, the role of the synagogues, fundamentalist Jewish rabbis in Palestine who defend and justify the killing of Arabs. Now, that doesn't mean that, by definition, the church is bankrupt because of that, or the synagogue or the Judaism is bankrupt because of that alone. But I think too often there is a sense that, I would argue, you really can't separate, in many cases, religion and politics when it comes to the reality of how religion is used and abused and practiced. The average person doesn't probably go to church on a Sunday and think about the fact that the church supported the junta in Latin America in the 70s. Most wouldn't think that every day, probably for their sanity. But at the same time, the fact is that the church in Latin America, as an example, or the church in Africa or elsewhere, is deeply embedded within the reality of imperialism. I mean, this is what the church and the synagogues and Islam and all religions have become. Look at, for example, what happened in India last week. The world's largest democracy has elected, I would say unfortunately, but it's their choice, a potentially fundamentalist Hindu regime.
But now, why is that so, is the question. India is a particular democratic example. Why is it that people want to revert or want to pull on deeper values? The appeal is, no, there is something authentic back in our past that we need to reclaim. You even see it in our own society here in Australia today.
It's not about values, it's about identity. Yeah. What has happened in India over the last 30 years with the rise of Hindutva, this conception of Hindu nationalism, which expresses a weirdly orthodox version of Hinduism, and there is no bigger oxymoron than Hindu orthodoxy. Those two words just should not belong in a single sentence, and yet that's precisely what Hindutva and the BJP express. What they've managed to do is tap into a feeling among many, many Indians, a feeling of being unmoored by the changes in society, by the shifting racial landscape, political landscape, economic landscape. It's a very simple message. It's about who are you? Who are you as an individual? Your Hinduness, whatever that means, is paramount in how you identify yourself. And so, by connecting that Hinduness with this sort of political group, there is this promise of greater peace, greater prosperity, etc., etc. That works everywhere. That's how elections work in the United States, for sure. I mean, I'm not sure how they work particularly here in Australia. If
we've
you
got
actually
some recent
have
experience
politicians
in that
who actually try to divide you for their votes, I don't know. Is that something?
Never happens
no?
here.
Never happens here.
Never,
no,
never.
No.
No. Our Prime Minister is a saint.
But, I mean, another perfect, simple example is what has happened in Iraq. I was born in Baghdad, and I lived there until I was almost 17. And I remember at school, we didn't know who were the Shia Muslims and who were the Sunni Muslims. We were aware that there were two Christian lads in my class, and we knew they were Christians because they were let off RE lessons. They could go and kick a football about in the stadium, in the playground. But no one knew who was Sunni or Shia. No one cared. But with the Troubles, this needing to identify with one side or the other, you know, the Sunni and Shia struggle now, you know, and horrific sort of tit-for-tat, suicide bombings and so on is taking place, not because we believe that you should pray five times a day and you say three times a day, or right. We follow the Imam Ali and you follow one of the other companions of the Prophet. They don't care. It's about we are our group. We identify as Sunni, you identify as Shia. We're different.
By the way, this is going to be a phenomenon that is simply going to increase, unfortunately, partly as a result of globalization, as Anthony said, and the breakdown of secular nationalism as an ideology. In the 20th century, the very concept of secular nationalism was that if you just simply put aside your religious and ethnic identities and instead define yourself based on the nation state as free and individual, equal citizens, geographically constrained, then what will result is peace and prosperity. And what did we get? the two most devastating wars in the history of humankind in the name of nationalism, and followed immediately by globalization's attack on national identity and the very concept of nation states and national borders. Well, what's happening is, as nationalism is beginning to diminish, then other forms of identity are going to take its place, more primal forms of identity, like ethnicity, like religion. And so when you have a strong man in place, like Saddam Hussein, who, despite the fact that this is a completely fabricated nation made up by some, you know, white guy in London, he can maintain a national identity because he is the identity of the state. But when he is gone and now it's time for those citizens to define what it means to be us, turns out nationality isn't at the top of that agenda. There are other more visceral, more primal forms of identity that rise to the top.
You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio. We're at the Sydney Writers' Festival with Jumail Khalili, Anthony Lowenstein and Reza Aslan. All our normal bits and pieces on Sunday night still to come.
What then, if we are to move into a world in which the sort of fundamentalist forms of religion, those forms of religion which command a certain obedience to a set of words in a book, are to be moved aside, and we still recognise that there is an impulse for people to feel a common identity, a shared identity. How then is that to be shaped? We've seen the market do it, or attempt to do it. And there's an argument about science too. Some people said, look, all you need to have is a rational approach and that will take you along the path to higher enlightenment. And we saw what sort of rational materialist secularism did with communism in either in Stalinist purges or Mao's purges. Yet we still need some sense of coherence, some moral universe to operate in.
I don't agree with you putting in that word materialist after rationalist, suggesting that if we have a rationalist scientific view, the inevitable path is towards Maoism or Stalinism.
I wasn't suggesting that was inevitable. But
I mean, you know, there are good and bad atheists and there are good and bad religious people. You know, people are people. But for me, I mean, I would still argue, well, what's wrong with us all being humanists? You know, just valuing and respecting each other. The British Humanist Association is very much a non-religious, secular organisation, but there's no reason why you can't, and historically we have had humanist Christians. You know, believing in a divine creator doesn't somehow conflict with the notion of respecting fellow humankind. So rationalism, for me, does not require this sense of I have to belong to a gang, I have to belong to a group, I have to have one. Maybe I'm being naive. No, you're not being naive.
And I would say that what you're saying, Jim, is, I mean, rather than calling it humanist Christian, you should just call it Christian. Because we have this tendency to believe that it's the extremes that are the majorities. You said something a moment ago, John, about fundamentalism going away. I don't think it's going anywhere.
I was making an assumption.
And the reason it's not going anywhere is that fundamentalism is not an independent phenomenon. It is a reactionary phenomenon. Fundamentalism requires something to react against, whether it is scientific progress or liberalism. And indeed, by the way, the very term fundamentalism, which arose in the early 20th century, was a response to Christian liberalism among European and American evangelical Christians who reverted to the fundamentals of their faith. So as long as there is societal progress, there will always be those who, because they feel left behind, will react in fundamentalist ways. But to me, when I see sort of surges of fundamentalism, I think that's great because it means that it's science and progress and liberalism that is surging, and this response to it is what we are seeing.
I guess one of the things also that comes to mind hearing this conversation is the argument of how we as a society and the press frames fundamentalism. I mean, the idea that, and this is something that I've written a lot about over the years, that so many of the individuals and groups who appear in our press, Australia, US, Europe, wherever it may be, who are framed as moderate and normal and rational, religious or otherwise, are actually the opposite of that. If you're coming on television regularly calling to bomb countries and you're framed as a rational actor, This is how our press operates. Our press operates with individuals who are generals or conservatives or liberals, for that matter, who support bombing of other countries. And I mention this because my, I guess, professional life really came into play in a post-9/11 environment, whether it's Israel, Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Middle East and elsewhere. And it continues to amaze me how our press, this is both the so-called liberal press, the ABC, bless them, and the more conservative press, continue to give airtime to individuals and frame them as rational and moderate. I'm not saying they shouldn't be heard. I'm simply saying that people who are calling for extreme actions, religious or otherwise, the idea that someone who is able to advocate for a state, in my view, such as, say, Israel, to maintain an occupation indefinitely, which is what a lot of hardline and so-called moderate Jews advocate, that to me is not a moderate position. It's an extreme position. And I don't think it matters how we necessarily label someone, but I think it does matter that we choose in our society and our press from the liberal side to the more conservative side, I think, refuse to call people who they are. But if you're calling for an ongoing, never-ending war on terror and the belief that America has the right, as the Obama administration does, that we have the right to assassinate people wherever we want, that is not a moderate position. It's an extreme position with a justification either of religion. Obama is religious, but is not like Bush in terms of articulating that so much. But I would argue that his policies are just as extreme, if not more so, because there's the veneer of liberalism about him. And I think there's a failure of a lot of the discussion in our, particularly in our press, and I say this as a journalist, where we don't actually give a wide enough range of views and go to the same people over and over again to hear certain discussions who actually are advocating extreme views. And I think it's a problem, and I think our press has a lot to answer for about that.
Jim, let me come to you on one point you raised a moment ago about moving towards a sort of a humanist consensus about the sort of nature of the human person, whatever. Yet, even at the moment, there are arguments about the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights and people who are actively arguing, no, that's determined by a Western Christian understanding of what human rights are. That is not a definition of human rights we share or want to share. That is still a lively discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I regard myself as left-leaning liberal, as most academics tend to be, but I'm not a cultural relativist. So I don't, you know, this notion that, well, you know, what might seem okay for you in your culture, in your society, is very different than ours. This is okay for us to do. No, I don't just, you know, I mean, there are some basic ideas like chopping off hands or genital mutilation or the whole homophobia and so on, which is very easy for people in an enlightened society. I don't mean West or East or anything, but an enlightened society to understand that they are wrong. There are lots of other things, you're right, which are greyer. But I still think there should be, we should be able to come to a consensus Declaration of Human Rights that we can all agree on. I don't believe it's a Western construct, and for the same reason that I don't believe that holding moral or ethical values are Christian values. They are what define humanity. There are ethical and moral guidelines that we should be able to agree on that are common to all humanity. It sounds like motherhood and apple pie here, but they should be able to transcend different cultures, different belief systems.
It's a problem that goes back as far back as Kant sort of articulated. You can construct a moral universe which doesn't require religion, but whatever is going to make people want to follow it, because it involves making decisions which are not in your immediate self-interest. And that is something that somebody who's thought a lot about can get to that point. It takes a lot of struggle and a lot of self-discipline. Most people just aren't going to go there.
Well, it depends on whether you're an optimist about the human nature or not, whether you think people are by default inherently good on the whole, and I think they are. I mean, that's what defines me as a humanist. I see the positive in people. I think people on the whole know right from wrong, that we have a conscience that tells us whether you don't just do things for self-interest. There will always be people who do, but on the whole, most people are decent.
That's getting to a pretty foundational argument.
Yeah, and yet we live in most Western societies where the market is worshipped. And despite the fact that in the global financial crisis, the market failed profoundly, there has really been little change in how the market works, and there's been virtually no accountability. In fact, one of the remarkable things is that the Obama administration has prosecuted no one serious about that issue at all, not one single person, and we wonder why people still worship the market.
Reza, even somebody like Arthur Koestler wrote a whole book called The Ghost in the Machine, in which he tried to struggle with this. Are we innately good and eventually rationality will prevail? Or is there something in the mechanism that does need to be addressed from time to time?
Well, look, the way it works is you have to be focused on your self-interest. But that's what the social contract theory is all about. That it's in your self-interest to live in a society in which you can't steal from each other and you can't kill one another because it protects you and your property and your life. Do you need God in that equation? No, not necessarily. But, you know, I think what Jim was saying earlier is one that it's sort of the biggest criticism that I have of religious people is this, and this very argument too, that, well, you know, it's religion is what keeps us moral, keeps us in line. Mm. If you believe in God, if you are good, if you don't steal and kill and lie and cheat because you think you're going to get some reward afterwards, then you're a child. Mm. So, you know, if that's your religiosity, then, you know, you've got the faith of a little kid. For most of us, I think we understand that we do good, we maintain our moral values because that's the kind of society we want to live in.
The definitional question of the word religion, I mean, the root of the word is ties that bind, that which binds us together. So in talking about religion, I guess we've been focusing on the sort of Abrahamic traditions and the transcendent deity who's going to come down there and sort of tap you on the head if you've done the right thing or the wrong thing. But we talk about a much broader concept of religion, say that it embraces Hinduism, Buddhism, whatever, where the Dharma is the way. It's how you live out your life. And here, is religion a much more interesting playing field to encounter and a much more open tablet? Because you could then get into discussions about whether or not you find a language that uses poetry legitimately, that expresses the higher things, that, I could take a crude example again, to explain the biology of the daffodil is not to be William Wordsworth. There is a profound difference there. And that level of spirituality, I guess, that we've had a very confined understanding of religion.
There was a famous quote by the American physicist Richard Feynman, who became very annoyed by a friend of his, an artist. So this is not someone talking from a spiritual perspective, but saying, I as an artist appreciate the aesthetic beauty of a flower, whereas you as a scientist, you will decompose it and down to its sort of molecular structure, and you turn it into something devoid of spiritual aesthetic beauty. And Feynman said, why? Why? Because I too can see the beauty in the flower that you can see. I too can appreciate its scent. I too can feel spiritually uplifted, even though I don't believe in a divine creator. But in addition to that, I will understand how the colors are formed. I'll understand how the light is absorbed. I will understand how the bee comes to pollinate and why it's attracted to the flower. I'll understand the molecular composition within the cell structure of the petals. I see what you see, and I see more. So I don't think you need, you talk about the open tablet requiring, you know, needing some spirituality to open up our world, to make it richer. I don't see that as necessary.
Well, and for me as a person of faith, it's within that, the elemental nature of that flower that I actually experience and understand the divine. That's where the divine lives for me. The divine is not something out there. It's not some anthropomorphic figure that, you know, I pray to in order to win a football game, though I do sometimes.
Hey, you know,
and it works, right?
Yeah,
and it works.
I mean, the Sufis believe that there can be no separation between creator and creation. That God, whatever God is divine unity. Well, what that means is that all things, everything that exists, exists insofar as it shares in the existence of the only thing that exists, which means that everything is God. And so for me, that kind of deep scientific dive into the nature of reality is a spiritual exercise.
Which is, well, what Einstein would talk about when he refers to the term God. You know, Einstein wasn't religious in that sense, but for him, God, the divine, was the laws of nature, the wonders of the universe itself.
Yeah. But is it more than that, Reza, for you?
For me?
Yeah.
No. For me, it is in desire to commune with the nature of reality, not just to know it, not just to study it, but to recognize what I have in common with it, to understand that that which makes that flower is the same thing that makes me, that there is an animating spirit in both of us that we share, that ultimately what is made up of this thing and that thing has always existed and will always exist. These are scientific facts. These are not religious truths. And for me, it's not enough to just know it. What I want to do is feel it and commune with it. Now, how does one do that? Well, what I am describing is an indescribable experience. It's an undefinable experience. That's what faith is. It's ineffable, it's mysterious, it's individualistic. How can you talk about something that is by definition beyond the human mind's capability of fathoming? Well, you need a language in order to talk about it. A language made up of symbols and metaphors, because you can't talk about it in any other way except through metaphors. And that's what religion is. It is merely a unified set of symbols and metaphors that give us the opportunity to express to ourselves and to one another the ineffable experience of faith.
Then if religion is not going to go away, how is it going to be useful to us? How is it, as it has been in the past, a primary culture bearer?
And destroyer. And will continue to be probably both. I mean, again, it depends on the religion, etc. I mean, I guess one of the things that I've often thought about, and the reason sometimes I go on a bit more about Israel-Palestine, is I think as someone with that background, I have more responsibility to speak out, to criticise, to engage on an issue where I have more chance of having an effect. I can talk about Islam as much as I want, and I have and I do. I don't claim to be an expert in Islam at all. I'm not an expert in Judaism either. But I think we have a responsibility, I feel, as individuals, if we happen to be Jewish and realise that if Israel claims to speak as it does for all Jews, that as a Jew I can arrive there tomorrow, assuming they let me in, which is sometimes challenging, but I can go there and probably, maybe, possibly, become a citizen in a short amount of time. And a Palestinian who has far more connection to that land simply can't do that. Now, that is, to me, inherently based on a racist concept. And because of what happened to Jews in the 20th century, and for that matter, a long time before, it is even more reason why what we as Jews are doing must be condemned. And I'm encouraged by the fact in the last years that there are growing numbers of young Jews who do share that view, who are speaking out. And that is why I think in decades to come, the people who are most likely to be the strongest supporters of Israel are Orthodox Jews and fundamentalist Christians, which to me is actually a very perfect way to represent what Israel is and what it's becoming.
Most people still retain some, as Christopher Hitchens articulated, Christopher Hitchens at the start, of some visceral feeling that somehow their society is bound by a common set of beliefs, and somewhere deep down that taps for them into what they might call spirituality. Will Durant, the American historian of the sort of mid-century, made the observation that a society and its religion fall together. They rise together and fall together. And one, in some ways, is an expression of the other. Reza?
Well, it's absolutely true that there's no such thing as religion in a vacuum, that all religions are intimately, inextricably tied to the soil out of which they arise and the soil out of which they develop. What we call, you know, Christianity in Australia is wildly different than what they call Christianity in the Philippines, which is wildly different than what they call Christianity in El Salvador. It's part of the culture. That's where religion arises, which is why it becomes very difficult to make statements about religion, you know, that religion is this and religion is that and Christianity does this and the Muslim world does that, because what you are talking about is something that is so infinitely diverse, it becomes very, very difficult to make general statements about.
Would you thank our panel, Reza, Anthony and Jim?
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.